supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a timely show for you this week, Cats and Kittens. In the question of the week, we'll be talking about one of the worst garden and landscape pests, voles, V-O-L-E-S, with some new information. At least it's new to us. We're also going to be talking about grafting tomatoes, putting the variety you want onto a super tough rootstock to prevent dread disease and other problems. And of course, we got to take lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sandra, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks very much, Mr. McGrath. I'm real happy to be able to talk to you about this.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Sandra. Where are you?
I live on the island of Culebra, and that's halfway between Puerto Rico and the island of St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands.
Oh, my goodness. Do you pick up one of our radio broadcasts from the Virgin Islands?
Yes, we listen to NPR, and I think it comes from the station at St. Thomas.
I keep telling them I need to go down and inspect the facilities there, preferably January of some year.
Yes.
I was in Cuba this past January, and it was just a delightful respite from the horrifying winter we had back home.
That was the worst winter you've had in a long time.
Terrible, terrible. What can we do for you, Sandra?
I'm very concerned about several large areas of Sansevieria, the mother-in-law's tongue, that are just out of control in my yard and close to my house. And a few of them looked very beautiful with the other foliage, but I've tried to remove them and I really could use some tips.
You know, it's funny. I saw this plant in Cuba outdoors. Uh-huh. Now, even before I went to Cuba and saw them in, quote, the wild, I realized from my own little garden of house plants how possibly invasive these things could be, because these were plants that should have died on me, that were at the very back of a big layer of plants that I ignored. And not only did they not die, but the root system got so dense it broke the pot open.
See? Okay, so you have some clue what the war I have with these plants.
I imagine this has an underground root system like bamboo.
I don't know about bamboo, fortunately.
Yeah, but you do know about this now. How long has it been in the ground?
Maybe 5 years.
And how tall are the plants?
Big, healthy spears, about 4 feet tall.
Now, what have you done to try to control them? Have you pulled them out of wet soil?
What I tried to do was to dig them out, but they have huge tubers that are like giant carrots. They're
yes.
Bright orange. I dug down at least 2 feet. I'm still running into big, fat, healthy tubers. I know I physically cannot get all of them out. They're 20 feet out from where you see the nearest tongues coming up.
What we advise in situations like this is that you don't try to dig out the entire root system, because as you found out, all you're doing is breaking it into little pieces and planting more.
Yeah.
So you have two choices. The one choice that we always talk about with bamboo is what we call the rope-a-dope method, and that you find something like, I would think maybe a machete would be good at slicing these things off at ground level, or a giant pair of lopers, like oversized pruners.
Mm-hmm.
And you just cut the above ground growth back every 2 weeks or every month. Doing that, you force these underground root systems to expend all their energy growing up new leaves, but you're cutting off the new leaves before they can fuel a lot of energy back to the root system. So that's one way. Now, your other option is to solarize the soil, which will bake the roots to death. I would imagine where you are in the tropics, that you could solarize a level piece of ground in 2 months. And what you would do is literally mow the plants down, really scalp it down to the ground. And then you would soak the soil and you would pull clear plastic tight over top of it during the hottest part of the year. I would think 2 months covered with clear plastic would really knock that root system back. And if you see it's doing well, leave it on even longer. Either one of those will get rid of the plants without you having to dig up the entire root system, which I fear will be an impossible task.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your help.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Rob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
I'm doing good. Rob, how are you, sir?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
And where is Rob doing well?
Newark, Delaware area.
What can we do for Rob in Newark, Delaware?
I've been listening to your show, trying to practice organic gardening. Got a pretty decent vegetable spread. But every once in a while, the missus comes home with things for the lawn and garden. And I've got like 2 big gallons of weed killer that I don't know what to do with. I'm afraid to just throw it in the trash. I'm not sure if there's a way to dispose of it properly.
Now, you take care of the lawn and garden, I'm presuming.
But for the most part, we do it in general, yes.
Are there weeds in the lawn?
No, it's mainly the Roundup was purchased for like cracks in the sidewalk, and it wasn't what I prescribed to. Right.
How recently did these quote-unquote things come home?
Last summer.
Okay, that's not bad. Were they opened?
They weren't used, no.
Okay. How about just taking them back to the store?
But in the years past, they probably don't want that.
Because your products, so to speak, are, and they're all relatively new. They're all a year old or around that?
Yes, approximately.
Okay. I would return them to the store, not necessarily asking for a refund. I would take them back and say, this has not been opened. We're deciding not to use it. You can either put it back out on the shelf because it's still sealed, or you can return it to the manufacturer. We're not asking for a refund, but we don't want it around in our garage. Maybe you go in as a team, and if they're giving you a hard time, cause a diversion, knock over a display of gardening gloves somewhere at the other end of the store, and then when they turn around, you're gone, but the weed killers are still there on the counter. But, you know, you bring up a really important topic. If this stuff was older, and you think of all the homes, garages, basements that have... Some people have stuff from the 50s and the 60s down there in cans that are leaking or in bags that are starting to fall apart. And what do they do with these things? And the answer is household waste disposal programs. And I have yet to encounter a state or a county or a township that did not sponsor what's called a hazardous waste disposal program. You can bring them to what may be the county composting site or the municipal township building or something like that. But they will have professionals there who will take this material and if it's leaking or dangerous, will neutralize it right away. Or at the very least, they will take it from you and then it will go towards a proper disposal. Now, as to the weeds coming up in the cracks, the long-term issue, should your wife go, like, out to her car and see a dandelion and take it personally and you know, want to go back to the bar and start drinking again, so to speak, get her a flame weeder. Go online and just type in flame weeder. The one I use is Burns-O-Matic. You know the people who make the propane torches for sweating pipes and stuff? Yeah, Burns-O-Matic makes something called the yard and garden torch or the outdoor torch. It's just a long shepherd's hook kind of thing. You screw a little bottle of propane, the camp stove size bottle on one end, and they have an electric ignition. You just press a button. And a propane flame comes out the other end. And all you have to do to kill a weed in like a sidewalk crack is walk the flame over top of it and dehydrates it. But if that feels good to you, you can stand there for 20 minutes if you want, you know, until there's nothing left but cinders. But that's a great way to take care of these little weeds without any bending over, without any kind of spraying, and you're not harming the environment at all. All right, Rob?
Thank you very much.
All right, good luck, sir. And if you need a decoy for when you take these things back to the store, I'm your man. I'm good at knocking over those displays.
Very good. Thank you, sir.
All right, take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody with itchy planting fingers that summer crops like tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants, frost is not the only issue. These are tropical plants that despise temps in the 40s. So you're not looking for your first frost-free date. You're looking for an upcoming weather forecast around your frost-free date, where the nighttime temps are going to stay reliably in the 50s. Don't shock your summertime plants with an early chill. And don't do anything with them right now, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, the possible benefits of grafted tomatoes, and how to outwit wily voles. I'm Voley Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com. And Star Roses and Plants, the company that introduced the Knockout family of roses. Drift roses are low-maintenance, disease-resistant, and hardy to zone 4, a cross between full-size ground cover roses and miniature roses that bloom all season. More at starrosesandplants.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, more information about voles than you already know. We virtually guarantee we'll tell you something new about these plant-eating vermin. And, of course, lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Chelsea Fields from the Burpee Seed Company, who is here to talk to us about grafted tomatoes. Chelsea, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. I'm so happy to be here.
You've been here a number of times, haven't you?
I have. I think last time most recently was herbs.
Right. Pinnacle herbs, the herbs that you guys grow at the top of some, like, rugged mountaintop to imbue them with vigor.
That's right, and tons of flavor and oil.
All right, which we want. We want oily herbs, ladies and gentlemen. But we're not here to talk about oily herbs. We're here to talk about grafted tomatoes, which is, you know, this is a huge topic with gardeners right now. This is the topic du jour.
I think it has to do with all the popularity of heirlooms, and people are realizing that you can get the heirloom taste, but with some of the hybrid benefits through grafted.
And people think that this idea of grafting tomatoes, you know, basically taking the rootstock of one type of tomato and grafting another variety on it, is like new and exciting. And it is exciting, but I think it goes back to the 40s.
Wow. Well, I think because, I mean, the benefits are there. You know, there's always the hybrid benefit that could come through with your heirlooms.
But with certain tomatoes, we know they've been bred to be resistant to different diseases.
Yeah, that's right.
To me, this is the reason, the first reason, the biggest reason that someone would grow a grafted variety. And this is also a good time of year to warn people, you can't keep planting tomatoes in the same spot year after year. Whether you're organic, whether you're chemical, whether you're raised bed container or a flat earth gardener, after about the third year, there's going to be a wilt building up in that soil that I still think is poorly understood, right? Why this happens, this symbiotic relationship. But it happens no matter what. After tomatoes' roots have been in the same soil for about 3 years, you get one of the, quote, wilts. And what happens that first year your tomatoes are affected is the leaves will start yellowing on the bottom and it will progress up the plant. And if you don't get the hint, it'll happen real fast the next year. So it's all in the soil. You know, it's almost reassuring to some people because they think they have a blight. But as you and I both know, you know, people love to grow tomatoes and everybody's gardening in smaller spaces every year. And many of us, myself included, we'd be out of rotating space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that happens, like you said, if you have limited container space, if you have just one raised bed that you're going into year after year, you don't have the options to rotate.
And one of the things we've told people in the past is some tomatoes, especially hybrid varieties, will have letters after their name. And if you have the wilt in your soil or you just want to play it smart and not keep planting a disease-prone tomato, let's say, you buy a tomato that has the letters V and F after the name for verticillium and fusarium, and those are the two prominent wilts. But this is another way of attacking it, and to me, this is a great idea to, I would imagine, have you found the rootstock with, like, total resistance to these wilts, or is it just number one? What is it?
Most things we found varying levels of resistance. So there's highly resistant, there's low resistant, and it depends on which rootstock is selected. But it's still going to be better than something with no resistance at all.
So you found a tomato that may or may not be a great eating tomato. My understanding is some of the rootstocks produce really poor tomatoes.
Right. Many of them are from wild stocks originally.
But you're not going to get those tomatoes. Sometimes it's hard for people to understand grafted plants, that the part that's in the ground is not going to be the part that delivers the fruit.
That's correct. Yeah, it's just really passing on the benefits of the resistance that it has to the scion that you mentioned that has the delicious heirloom fruit.
So we have some samples here in the studio. Turn your radio up so you can see these wonderful little baby tomatoes. The first one I'm picking up is absolutely one of my all-time favorite paste tomatoes, San Marzano. Mm-hmm. And it's not Super San Marzano or any of the improved varieties. This is the old original. And I guess San Marzano is an heirloom, right?
It is. Mm-hmm. And the fruits are smaller, like you said. They're about 4 to 5 ounces generally, as opposed to the Super San Marzano.
But they're very meaty, and they are, to my mind, one of the standards for paste tomatoes, or even fresh eating, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, really strong flavored, both fresh and cooked, small core. So they're a beautiful tomato, but they just have some issues in the garden soil.
Another favorite tomato, mortgage lifter. Mm-hmm. I know Burpee is always breeding new, bigger tomatoes. Tomatoes the size of a child's head. You need two hands. Don't Don't sue us if you pull a tendon lifting these giant tomatoes, ladies and gentlemen. But Mortgage Lifter, wouldn't you say that this is the original, like, bragging tomato?
Yeah, I mean, the name and the story of Mortgage Lifter came for the size alone. You know, it really, it helped that guy to get his house out of hock because of how giant they were.
Radiator Charlie. And they're not only big, but they're actually great tasting tomatoes. What else we got? Black Crème. Anybody who hasn't grown the Black Russian tomatoes, they just don't know what they're missing. Mm-hmm. Just a big fruits, beefsteak size fruits with really striking color, really unique color inside of that Black Russian thing. And to my mind, a naturally smoky flavor.
That's the exact word I would use. It's that smoky, unctuous, sit-on-your-tongue quality that's so great with Black Crème.
And then finally over here, you know, you brought all my favorites. Big Rainbow, which I originally grew as a tomato called Georgia Streak, which I believe are the same tomato. But this is, again, I mean, if you want to really move up in the tomato world, this is seems to be a giant yellow tomato, right?
With some pink coloring.
And then it develops this little red dot on its hiney down at the blossom end. And then that sunsets throughout the entire fruit. Mm-hmm. And to my mind, Big Rainbow, Georgia Streak, I think it has several other names, has the perfect blend of sugars and acids.
Yeah, and it's really bright and it's fruity and then it mellows. And like you said, it's kind of the full taste range.
Now, on these tomatoes, I will tell people that when they get a grafted tomato, I don't know how other companies do it. You're not the only one offering this. But you have a little plastic clip over where the graft is, showing where the rootstock meets the top part. This has been improved, right, in the greenhouse, because I can remember seeing the first mass-produced, let's say, grafted tomatoes maybe 3 years ago, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. And the rootstock was obvious. It was pretty knotty. It looked like someone had tied a rope down there. Mm-hmm. And this is not obvious.
Yeah, we've really worked to get really clean graft merging so that there's no, like you said, knottiness or projections on the side of the stem. You know, it's a really clean merge. And we also work to get them higher up on the stem.
Excellent. Because one of my issues with the first run of grafted tomatoes was that the graft was pretty low. And one of the things you should always do is plant your tomatoes as deep as possible because, unlike other garden fruits, let's say, tomatoes will grow auxiliary roots along their buried stem. So that is a great movement forward, is to keep moving that graft up so you can get the benefits of the buried stem. Again, obviously, to me, there's huge benefit for people who are out of rotation space to have rootstocks that are resistant to this soil-borne disease. That's probably the number one or number two problem with tomatoes. But I'm hearing from you, I'm kind of hearing an implication that there's other things going on with the rootstocks.
That's right. So I agree. I mean, I think the wilts, because they're coast to coast, border to border, everyone has those wilts going on.
And they're in the soil.
But there's definitely some other benefits, like for the South, for instance, nematode resistance.
And again, there's something that's in the soil.
Mm-hmm. Something that, like you said, if you're out of rotation space and you're not refreshing the soil every year, you're dealing with it every year. And all of these rootstocks have a high resistance to root knot nematode. And along with those benefits, you can even get some cold soil tolerance.
Because that's another good thing to talk about at this time of year, is people obsess about the last frost date. And that is meaningless, ladies and gentlemen. That means nothing. Just because your tomatoes don't die of being actually frozen, they're tropical plants. They have no sense of humor about nighttime temps in the 40s, much less the 30s, right?
Yeah, you can look out and see them shivering sitting
there. You really can. So this is not going to go away, is it? This is like native plants. This is like heirlooms. If what I've been seeing in the gardening world holds true, we're going to see more and more grafted varieties and see them in more places every year.
I think that's the trend. And I think you're just going to get to see better and more varied benefits of different types of grafted vegetables.
And can people get these plants at retail? I've seen grafted tomatoes at retail. I'm not sure I've seen Burpee ones.
Right. We do have grafted tomatoes at retail. They're in the Burpee Home Garden labeled pots under the Bumper Crop brand because of all the great yield that you'll get out of your grafted plants.
Okay. Very good. Well, Chelsea Fields from the Burpee Seed Company, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden again.
Okay. Thanks. Always fun with you, Mike.
And full disclosure, Burpee is one of the underwriters of You Bet Your Garden. And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Eric, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing well today. Eric, how are you, sir?
Very good.
And where is Eric very good?
Center Hall, PA.
Well, I don't know where that is.
It is right outside of State College.
Oh, okay. You're one of our State College listeners. What a great new audience we picked up there in the central part of Pennsylvania. Okay, what can we do for Eric near State College, PA?
Okay, so my wife and I, we just bought a house, and there's a great place for a garden, but it's been used for, oh my gosh, several years now. They've just been composting everything from hop vines to Concord grapevines, and you name it, it's in there.
Right.
So, our plan was to just turn over the garden, which I've already done. I dug a hole to compost everything a little bit faster. But we were wondering, would it be better to wait and let this summer just the nutrients and everything break down through the garden? Because just digging it all up, it seems to not been composted because they've just been putting these vines and sticks in there from raspberry bushes and everything else. And it's just not breaking down.
You have a big open area near your new home where people have just been piling up every form of plant trash, from woody stuff to vines to everything.
Yes.
But these things aren't actually growing in the ground, right?
No, this is stuff that they are. These are all clippings from after the hop vines are cut down and the grapes are cut down.
I have to stop you right there and say, did you inherit the hop vines and the grapevines?
Yes, and I actually have them ready to go already.
Okay, well, that's exciting. Boy, you got a lot of work to do. Now, there is an article on our website about hop growing. I don't know how much you've read, but remember with the grapevines that they do need to be pruned vigorously every winter. And then once the material begins to appear, you know you have to remove some of the grape leaves. I think it's around half of the grape leaves as the vines grow to keep the air circulation. And if you want the best grapes, you also need to remove clusters of grapes. It's like with fruit trees where you have to remove a lot of the early fruits to get really full-size ones at the end.
Okay. That's good to know because we have 7 fruit trees as well in this yard.
And are they flowering yet?
2 of them have started.
Okay. And have
and
you...
that's the pear and the plum.
You bought into a lot here. Have you pruned them yet?
No, I haven't.
Okay. There's no harm in pruning during flowering, but open them up. Get in there and remove quite a few of the branches. You might want to read a couple of articles. Again, on our website, we have a good article about fruit tree pruning. Really open them up. And then with at least some of your fruit trees, you're going to have to remove most of the young fruits to get good fruits at the end. Fruits are not easy. Grapes are not easy. So the basic answer here for this pile of rubbish, of garden debris, if you want to build a couple of raised beds in the spot that that's on because it gets the most sun or something like that, what you want to do is you just want to move the pile to anywhere else, to any open spot on your property where you don't have plants coming up, where it's not going to interfere with airflow. You don't want to bury it or anything like that. That's the reverse. Buried material does not break down. You want it to be above ground. And if they didn't really shred anything, if there's like lots of lumber in there, so to speak, big pieces of woody branches and grapevines, first of all, you're just going to pile it all up together. If you want that to become compost for you to use next year, you should probably get a chipper shredder, just rent it for a weekend and run everything through it, make it smaller. That's one reason it's not breaking down. Out in the wild, the kind of material you're describing would not become soil for 3 to 5 years. But you sound like you're in up to your knees already. You got a new house. I'm sure there's stuff to be done in there. You got these fruit trees and grapevines that you've seemed to unknowingly have adopted. What I would do if you want to grow some tomatoes or peppers or cucumbers or stuff like that, knock out a couple 4x8 raised beds. You're going to need to go slow. These fruits are going to take a lot of your attention, more than you can possibly expect. So move the stuff away and then drop down some raised bed frames that are around 4x8 or do it with pavers. Fill those with good soil. Go out and get some compost and some good topsoil and grow in that. Don't start with a flat ground garden. You're going to be a raised bed gardener, trust me. But this year, Eric, you're going to have more work to do than you can possibly imagine with the fruit trees and the grapevines. And again, by the time next year comes along, a lot of that material you'll have piled up will have become your new compost. So then you're going to start a nice system of adding on every year.
All right, that sounds great.
All right, good luck, Eric. It's a great adventure.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too.
All right, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone who has salad greens growing in their early season garden that the best way to harvest those greens is with a pair of scissors. Go out there and cut them right into a salad spinner. Make sure you leave about 1 to 2 inches of stem and root in the ground, and that leaf will grow back for you. You don't have to wait until it heads up in the weather gets hot. Go out and cut your lettuce and spinach over and over again, cut and come again style, like those expensive ones in the supermarket. They're the same lettuces. You just get them when they're young and super sweet. But don't you go cutting your Lola Rosa down to the ground just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do when voles come a-calling. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com. And Star Roses and Plants, the company that introduced the knockout family of roses. Drift roses are low-maintenance, disease-resistant, and hardy to zone 4, a cross between full-size ground cover roses and miniature roses that bloom all season. More at starrosesandplants.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll have a very important question of the week. How to control voles, V-O-L-E-S, that do an awful lot of garden damage, including a type that we weren't aware of before in your lawn. That's right. All lawn damage is not moles. Voles do it, but they do it a very different way. You won't want to miss this exciting new information. And you won't. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Marilyn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Marilyn. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Thank you for asking. And where is Marilyn fine?
I am in West Alexandria, Ohio.
All right. What can we do for Marilyn in West Alexandria, Ohio?
I have a question about a program you had a few weeks ago. You gave instructions for planting tulips to try and save them to replant this fall because I didn't get them out last fall.
Everybody procrastinates, and there's no guarantees that anybody can force bulbs correctly even in the correct season, trying to do it when the bulbs are fresh. But I've been doing this quite a few years now, and I'm surprised at how often I succeed. You take your spring bulbs that for one reason or another you didn't plant outside, or in my case, I filled up the downstairs beer fridge with pots of these things because I had just run out of room outside. Now, I never use outside soil in my containers. So especially with something like spring bulbs, I use a very light, loose potting soil, no dirt in it. And I even lighten that up with more perlite. I just love perlite. It loosens the drainage up tremendously. And then, yes, you really saturate those pots. What I do before I force bulbs is fill up a sink with a couple inches of water, sit the pots in the sink, and then I let them sit there for hours until they're just totally saturated and drenched. And then I put little markers in, if I know the variety name, that's always nice to know, but the date that I put them into the refrigerator, and then I literally do not touch them again for 16 weeks. I don't water them. I do look at them occasionally when I open up the fridge to get a beer, because it is a beer fridge. You have to be careful not to have any fruit in the fridge, because that can make the bulbs sprout prematurely. So have they been in a fruit-free fridge?
Yes.
Okay, very good. And did you note the date when you put them in?
I didn't write the exact date, but it was about the 1st of March.
The 1st of March. So you got to go March, April, May, and June, I would say. And then bring them out. Now, my friend Art Walk has warned me that as we progress into the summer, things get a little tricky. Because if you do this to force bulbs in pots at pretty much close to the same time, within a month of when they come up outside, you can just take the pots outside when you're ready to bring them out and water them, and then they're in the right kind of environment. It's going to be July before you got a real chance with these things. I would keep them inside to protect them from the outside heat. If I remember correctly, they can't take extreme heat, you know, because spring bulbs are meant to come up in a very cool climate. Ours got snowed on this terrible year. But what you would do, and you said these are tulip bulbs, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you got to give them the full 16 weeks. Tulips, again, if I remember correctly, and I think I'm pretty close on this, they require the maximum chilling time or the most chilling time. But 16 weeks takes care of just about anybody. Now, if you wanted to cheat, really interestingly, I was looking through Art's book on bulb forcing the other day, and I'm pretty sure he said something like, once the 16 weeks has passed, you can either bring them out or you can leave them in the fridge, that you can leave them in the fridge for like another 16 weeks. So you could have spring bulbs in the fall, which would be really interesting. But after the 16 weeks, what you would do is bring them out, and then you would rehydrate them, really saturate them with moisture again, And then if it's really hot and sunny outside, I would treat them like orchids. I would have them like on a table in a lit room, or if they're going to get any kind of light, for it to be a diffuse light, like have a curtain in the window. But don't cheat on the 16 weeks. Water them once when they come out, and then put them out in a place where you're going to see them every day. Give them a little plant food and leave them outside until the leaves naturally lose their green color. And quite honestly, by that time, it'll be time to plant them in the ground or not plant them in the ground again.
Yes.
All right. Good luck, All right. Marilyn.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
You too. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Sue, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Sue. How are you?
I am hoping, I'm praying that you can help me. I've been listening to your show over the years and have heard all sorts of things, but this one's kind of got me.
Okay.
So I have been gardening in this organic garden. It's 20 feet by 40 feet.
Right.
And it is at my fiancé's home.
Okay.
And he had the landscaper come in and do landscaping in the garden beds, not the organic garden, but the beds. They edged around the organic garden, and they sprinkled something around the organic garden. And I found out what they sprinkled was something called Snapshot by Dow Chemical.
Oh, that doesn't sound good. That sounds like an herbicide.
It is an herbicide, and I called Dow, and they basically said, don't use your garden.
Where are you, Sue?
I am in Princeton, New Jersey. And what Dow told me was it would take about 6 to 8 months before I could safely grow vegetables in there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether to trust the chemical company or not.
Well, if they had said 6 to 8 days, you wouldn't trust them. But they're telling you not to eat anything grown in that area of this season.
That's right. They said that.
That's pretty honest.
The plant would bring these two chemicals up. I don't know whether you want them or not. Isoexabin and trifluralin.
Mm-hmm.
So that those are the two active ingredients. And they said the plant would take this chemical in, and it would be in the plant.
Right, yes. Those are called systemic herbicides and insecticides. They are taken up by the plant and theoretically don't kill certain types of plants or kill insects that munch on the plant or humans.
Okay.
You know.
So I'm at a loss to know what to do.
First, what are we going to do about the landscaper?
We're going to talk to him, and I don't have the results of that telephone conversation. The other thing that Dow Chemical said was if you want to do something about it this year, you have to remove 6 inches of the soil. Then we need to get rid of the soil. Then we need more soil. So it would be a total rehab of a garden.
And you ignore the fact that, first of all, you expose yourself to massive amounts when you do anything like that. And then what are you going to do with the contaminated soil?
Right.
My advice in these kind of situations is pretty much to let sleeping dogs lie. In that if it is granules, I would go out there with like a wet and dry vac, try to get up as much as I could, and then take that to a hazardous waste disposal site. But for this season, I would suggest that this is the year that you actually turn to true raised bed gardening. What you want to do is, as far away from the herbicide as possible, build a couple of true raised beds, 4x8, either framed with non-treated lumber or built out of pavers. The nice thing about pavers is you can always break those down and use them in a different form, and maybe that's something the landscaper can do, although it sounds to me possible that he didn't know he was doing anything wrong. So
that's right.
What you want to do is avoid that soil entirely. This is like when people start a garden in an urban garden and they want to get the soil tested. And I'm going, even if it's not filled with lead and cadmium, it's probably terrible soil. Although in your case, that's clearly not the case. But don't worry about it. We'll get back to it in a couple of years. But for now, what I would recommend is level what's in your square footage back there. And put down normally I recommend a single sheet of cardboard to prevent weeds. Let's put down two total layers of cardboard across all of your existing soil. It's like we're capping a landfill. And then drop either frames on top that are 4x8 or build raised beds out of pavers that are 4x8, no wider than 4 feet. We're not going to compress the soil. Make sure you have 2-foot walking lanes. Fill those with imported soil, a mix of compost and topsoil for this season, and that way you'll just avoid the issue. And then in a couple of years, I would say 2 years, but no matter what, you've lost that soil for this year.
Yeah. Here I am wanting to get my garden going, and I'm like, what do I do?
It happens to more people than you think.
Yeah. Well, okay. I guess I got some work cut out for me then.
Well, or they do, but you'll work that out over the dining room table as you're sitting there going,
that's right.
How are you going to make good here?
Ensure they're getting good soil.
You're going to go pick out the soil. You're going to see it. You're going to smell it. You're going to hold it. You're going to make sure it looks good, smells good, and feels good.
All right. You're the best, Mike. Thank you. You've given me hope.
Good luck, Sue.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Voles, little rodents that do a lot of damage. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started with a question, please.
Sure, Mike. Joe in Alexandria, Virginia writes, how do I control moles? My yard is tunneled to death. And what's the difference between a mole and a vole? Mike, you've always explained the moles create raised tunnels and voles don't, right? Are you changing your mind?
No, but I've been doing a lot more research on this, and it turns out that there are many different types of voles, and some of their behaviors can be radically different than the ones we've discussed in the past. But let's begin with a few things that haven't changed. Moles, M-O-L-E-S, live exclusively underground, make raised tunnels, mostly in lawns, often leave big piles of dirt on the surface, and only eat live food. That's earthworms, beetle grubs, and cicada larvae. They may uproot the occasional plant, but they don't eat any plants.
Okay, so Antoinette in Arlington, Virginia writes, our neighborhood has been invaded by voles, which have destroyed my grass. In the past, you would have said this was mole damage.
Absolutely. And moles are still the cause if the lawn has raised tunnels, dirt mounds, and soft areas that collapse when you walk on them. But if there are lots of little runways about 2 inches wide throughout the lawn, the cause is a specific type of vole, V-O-L-E, that eats the grass as it makes intricate above-ground pathways. The way to tell that it is not mole damage is by the distinctive little chewed-down runways, little holes about 1.5 inches in diameter all around, and the lack of dirt mounds.
All right, well, we'll finish with Jeannie in Westchester, Pennsylvania, who writes, how can I rid my garden and lawn of voles? They've chewed the roots and stems of my shrubs and other plants and are destroying my well-tended lawn. I don't want to use poison as I have a Labrador retriever. I've tried coyote urine and other repellents and even stuffing their tunnels with juicy fruit gum, but they're still out there.
Ah, yes. Voles in general are much better known for eating plant roots, underground bulbs and tubers, and for chewing on the bark of trees and shrubs, especially over the winter. Mounding mulch over the base of trees invites this damage by providing protection from predators. But snow cover can hide the little rodents just as well. That's why new planting should always be protected with tree guards or hardware cloth, a type of small mesh metal fencing that also keeps rabbits and deer from gnawing away.
And juicy fruit gum?
Ha! The juicy fruit trick has been around for decades. You generally hear it suggested for moles, which is just ridiculous, as moles only eat live food. I could maybe see a vole trying some, but I wouldn't rely on it for control. Now, there isn't good evidence that predator urines work, and their collection is cruel in the extreme. And poisons are to be avoided at all costs. They're a threat to children, pets, and raptors and other predators that can help keep these creatures under control.
Raptors? Like hawks and owls?
Oh yeah, they are very big predators of voles. Luckily, it was the beginning of Lent a couple of years back when my local church's front yard started showing signs of vole infestation. Lots of inch and a half wide holes near bulb and shrub plantings. So we changed the location of the big crucifix they traditionally put out for Lent and added smaller ones for the two thieves. By the time Easter arrived, hawks and owls had taken care of virtually all the voles.
Are you sure that's what it was?
Oh, yeah. The area under the crosses was covered with owl pellet evidence. Raptor perches can be very effective. Just a simple crossbeam about 6 feet off the ground, right over the damaged areas.
What else?
Well, on lawns, I would always start with a castor oil-based repellent that's labeled for use on moles and voles. It doesn't directly harm them. It chases them off by making the soil smell bad underground. Apply it heavily in the spring, before the females begin mating. One female vole can easily give birth to 100 tulip-eating offspring by the fall. Their fecundity is legendary. Removing mulches also helps. But they also like to hide under heavy ground covers like pachysandra, ivy, and low-growing junipers. In situations like that, traps can help limit their numbers. Simple mouse or rat traps baited with peanut butter placed around or over their runways and holes. Make sure you cover the traps with heavy cardboard boxes with little cartoon mouse holes cut out in the bottom so the voles can run in, but birds are kept out. And keep in mind that this is no single creature. Some voles mostly make above-ground runways. Others make extensive tunnel systems and do most of their eating underground. The different types can look and behave very differently, and even researchers disagree about some very basic aspects of their behavior. The one thing they all have in common, however, is that they're nocturnal, breed rapidly, and can cause a lot of damage. Well, that sure was some interesting information about voracious voles now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to visit me with voles if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your target report, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And when you email us,
please, please tell us your location. Please, please, we need to know where you live. Oh, it's so important.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Adam Staniszewski. Staniszewski, what a wine. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant is Marissa Nicosia. I'm Mike McGrath, and I'm going to go back to my underground lair and hide out, maybe chew on some tulip bulbs until I see you again next week. Although many people focus on kitchen waste, you can't make good compost without a lot of dry brown materials in the mix. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, I'll explain how to make compost without fall leaves. Plus answers to all your growing questions.